evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned for the next hour's interview, a little bit of a different show than what I have done before in the past. Tonight I'll be reaching back into Alaska's history, interviewing three members of the Lopez family of Valdez, people who've had unique experiences since arriving here before statehood in 1959, contributing to shaping our identity as Alaskans. These stories are an important piece of oral history that is too often forgotten, seldom communicated, and not always passed on to the new generations of Alaskans. Wikipedia says that oral history is the collection and study of historical information about individuals, families, important events, or everyday life using audio tapes, videotapes, or transcriptions of planned interviews, like this one. These interviews are conducted with people who participated in or observed past events, and whose memories and perceptions of these are to be preserved as an oral record for future generations. Oral history strives to obtain information from different perspectives, and most of these cannot be found in written sources. That's part of why I do this show, the Alaska Identity Project. I say project because that's what it is. It's an ongoing, evolving project to get to know ourselves better as Alaskans, and in the process, highlight amazing people, programs, organizations, companies, etc. to those living in our state as well as those living outside in the United States and around the world, people who are fascinated about what happens in the last frontier. When you Google state identity, you find out that it says a state can be discussed in terms of the many roles it plays in national, regional, and local government, and in terms of its history, geography, and demographics. Each state has a unique identity, evidenced by those of us who carry a lifelong allegiance to the place where we grew up, our home state. You can participate in the show tonight by writing in with your questions. If you're out there and you have questions for the guests in the studio, you can ask them by emailing me at adriennek@gmail.com, going to Facebook and posting a question on the wall of Alaska Identity Project, or following the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. The Lopez family came to Alaska in the late 40s, early 50s, originally settling up in Fairbanks and then later in the community of Valdez as commercial fishermen. Tilly Wonder, Tim Lopez, and Eric Lopez will tell their stories this evening of anything from the 64 quake to building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, as well as being a part of a religious community here in Southeast Alaska, among many other stories from Alaska's past. So welcome to the show, Tim, Tilly, and Eric.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on tonight.
I'd like to mention there's two more Lopezes that aren't here, Michael and Tommy.
Okay, so there's five siblings in the family, and two are not present, but three are in Juneau and are able to be here tonight to talk about some of the history of this family and its impact in Alaska. So let's start at the beginning. Tilly, we have Mike Lopez, the father of the family, came from the Lower 48 in the
California.
Late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about him as a person and why he chose to come up to Alaska.
I think it was a dream he always had, and probably when he was working, you know, when she was going through the war, he was in the Navy, and I think he heard a lot about it. And when my dad got something in his head like that, he had to go. And our mother was young, and I was almost two when we came up. And it was a rough road. Cause
you know, you drove the Alcan?
We drove the Alcan.
Alaska-Canada Highway, for those of you who don't know that.
And a Rambler, no less. And I don't remember stuff myself, but the pictures are pretty evident that it was quite a trip for them.
It was just a few years after they opened it for civilian use. That's very difficult.
Okay.
It was really hard. Right. There were very few people on the road, but Dad was always good at adventures.
And so they decided on Fairbanks versus
other areas
of Alaska?
I think we went to Fairbanks. Dad got fish poisoning when he was fishing, like our family likes to do. And so we moved. We went into the Delta Junction area there, and he worked at Fort Greely for a while as a jack of all trades kind of thing in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother, who was really young at the time, was a tough lady. We lived in it. Our first cabin was had a sod roof. They say it's the oldest cabin in the Delta area, which
really?
I didn't find out till somebody wanted to know if I had pictures of it, and I said I didn't. But then one day I found a picture, and I'm thinking, oh, that's me up on the roof, and that's sod, that's grass. I got the feeling at that point that. But I noticed. I remember Mom saying in the spring she wrote letters to her mother, which I was very lucky to get hold of.
Yeah.
She sent a letter home almost every other week or so. But at that point, in the spring when snow melted, the floor turned to mud. This is a little California girl, you know. She was really tough, though. So I've got some pictures of that. And then we moved to Fairbanks, where Michael and Tommy were born in Fairbanks.
Okay. So,
and Timmy.
And Timmy. Tim, who's here.
Well, yeah, but you were still living in the cabin when we...
Oh, where was I?
Yeah.
1955?
Yeah. We were in the cabin. Mm. There was the three of us.
You know, it was also a little note, family history, that Dad got a job going to Valdez and bringing a truck back, you know, like in the early 50s or something.
He had been to Valdez, yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess that must have been his first experience going to Valdez.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah.
So up in Fairbanks, so he was a guide and...
In Fairbanks, he was actually a musician. Dad was in the musicians' union, and that's how he made money when we first came to Fairbanks. And that's why after he got the fish poisoning in his hand, he couldn't... Because he played the piano and sang and everything.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, he was in the musicians' union. That's what he did. And then when that happened, we went to Delta. We lived in a tent, a big army tent for several months. And I remember distinctly one night when it was really, really windy, he had a coffee can sitting on top of the stovepipe where the little fireplace was in that cabin. I mean, in that tent. And the wind was blowing really hard, and it came off the roof, and he was outside chasing that can down.
Oh,
and I was like, okay, that's what it's like. My mother was very, very giving at that time, I'm sure.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. Wasn't Father have an engineering degree from Berkeley?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was Berkeley. It could have been.
I thought it was Berkeley, but I might be mistaken.
Okay. I wasn't sure about that.
He had an engineering degree, didn't he?
You know what, half the courses used Safi while he was in the military on minesweepers? And
okay.
Then he went on and completed a major in engineering
Bill,
and a
believe.
Minor in architectural science at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he came. And he hated both of them.
Yeah, he was.
He
didn't love it, that's for sure.
Remember Ketchum, the guy that did Dennis the Menace? He did his house. He was very good what he did, I have to admit.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he was good at it, but I don't think he loved it enough to do
no,
it the rest
fishing.
Of his life, you know. He
likes
sports.
He likes sports.
Outdoor stuff.
Adventures.
Very
adventurous. Many adventures at
yeah.
the drawing board.
Actually, he guided some famous people that came up to Alaska. Mm-hmm.
After he got to Valdez.
Oh,
yeah.
After he got to Valdez.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was...
Actually, if I remember correctly, I think he was involved in a subdivision, designing a subdivision that still exists in Fairbanks to this
well,
day. What was the name of that?
He had a business.
Island Homes. Mm-hmm. Island Homes.
Yeah, he built
which was in the early days of the subdivision boom of the U.S.
And he had a contractor. I mean, he had a partner.
Okay.
And
they
did contracting.
Okay, up in the Fairbanks area.
Yeah, Fairbanks area.
Okay, so then at some point, because he was driving trucks back and forth to Valdez, he decided... That was where he wanted to move.
He didn't go back and forth. I don't think he was a trucker. But, yeah, that's where he saw it for the first time, I think.
Okay.
And let's face it, it's
they were off-road dump trucks that came off of a ship, and they didn't have anyone to drive them back, and they just requested around to see who would do it. And he and some other guys said they would do it, and it was the first time that he had come. And when he got the Valdez and the water and everything that was there, he just fell in love with it.
Fell in love with it.
He drove it back there, and soon after that he made the decision to come down, and like Dad, he just made decisions and went and did it.
Got it in his mind.
He wanted to bring up a boat that he could use to guide people with, and he did. It was a ferocious trip, though.
Yeah.
It took him forever.
Wow. Valdez was always the port for Fairbanks, so, mm-hmm. you know, it was a general connection between Fairbanks and Valdez until many, many years, which to this day
is still
the port for
amount of
Fairbanks.
Tourists. That come to Valdez are from Fairbanks.
From Fairbanks, mm-hmm. people go
yeah.
fishing.
They're
yeah.
going fishing
place
and
to the ocean.
Boating and stuff.
Yeah,
that was
okay.
That's why. Yeah,
he gets to Valdez and buys a boat.
No, he brought it
well,
up. From,
he
bought it in Washington.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. He bought it in Washington. He brought it up and got all the way through southeast through Canada, through southeast Alaska. He was crossing the Gulf and he hit a log. It was a twin screw boat. It's called the Mike Strike.
The big
and,
Chrysler.
He bent one of the shafts on the boat, and in the process of sitting out a storm, he almost ran out of fuel and pulled into either Lutulia Bay or Tea Harbor, one of the two.
Lutulia
Bay, and he anchored up. They had about 5 gallons of fuel left. Knew they couldn't get into Cordova, and they really didn't know what they were going to do. So he left the guy that was on the boat with him on the boat, and he went and backpacked up to go see if he could shoot a deer or something on the beach. and he found 15 gallons of gas and three jerry cans stashed up there from some pilot that had burned up there years before. And he carried it back, one on his back, and carried two of them back, put them in the boat, and it just got him in far.
So, pretty lucky.
Well, my dad was never, he got involved in the charter business, or he got his, actually got his guide license, and then he bought the boat.
When we were still in California.
Yeah, okay. And then he bought the boat. But it was days before the internet. You know, there's, you sort of, what, you know, he wasn't, I would say, prepared as much as you could be today for that journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you left Cape Spencer, it was a whole other ballgame, as everybody in this country knows. And he turned out to be a great mariner, but I don't think that was his best trip he ever had.
No, but he did. It was quite the trip. I read the log. He kept a good log that time, which is unusual.
And it was such a small boat. I mean, by today's standards, it's 32-foot Owens. You know, that was dinky.
However, in Valdez at that time, there were only two major people that took – well, actually, there's three.
Okay.
There was the Gypsy, and then there was – Stan Stevens and Dad got together in those days, and in summertime, they'd get put up things on the – beat on the hotel there, and that's where they got their customers.
The customers.
And it's interesting that I forgot for a long time that they had worked at the same time. There was just one other guy that was doing the guiding.
I didn't know that. Stan was around those days, huh?
That was, and he had little
1960.
He had little boats.
That's right. He had skiffs almost.
Yeah. They were fiberglass.
It's the most dedicated guy I've ever met.
Well, and he's still around big time.
Later on, had a series of
Valley's
Cruises for those who've never been to Valley's.
He's been big in the after the oil spill and getting things better.
Yeah.
But Dan's still working.
So he guided a few famous people. Let's just wrap this part up.
What's his fate?
Well, Ted Williams was one of them, the baseball player.
Hillary.
And Sir Edmund Hillary, he's good at him.
Hillary came back every summer for a long time.
Wow.
They had a really good relationship.
Family. The second time he brought his family,
which
his two kids.
As a kid, I didn't know that he was so famous.
Well, it wasn't that much long. He arrived in Valdez before the earthquake, so that wasn't that much long after he'd climbed it. I think he didn't climb Mount Everest till like 58 or something.
59, yeah.
So it was, I think it was interesting as
We moved to Valdez in 61.
It was at... Dad's business was two-pronged. He took fishermen out for catching fish, like he did those fellows, but he also did charters for bears, or
guiding
for brown bears.
Oh, for brown bears.
So they were sort of two separate jobs that he had running his boat.
Okay, so people go and hunt a brown bear?
Yeah, just about that time is when they made the laws. Just right at the time that he did this, they made a law that you had to bring back the head of any brown bear.
Skulls.
He didn't know that at the time. It was like had just gone in. So he had to go back and find it. And the fun story is on that is it was already snowing. It was on Hinchinbrook, I think.
Yep.
And it was snowing already, and he was desperate to find the head of this bear. Because I don't know if you guys are all aware, but as a guide, you are like a policeman. And if you do bad things, they...
Take away your life.
So he went back to find that, and the fun part of that story was he was jumping over logs because he knew, and he jumped right on a hibernating bear.
No,
I'm serious. Only dad would have that kind of luck.
My
dad
didn't wake up.
Understand, my dad was at most about 5'5".
Yeah,
pretty small.
About 140 pounds. Maybe.
Yeah.
I have an interesting follow-up on that. I ran across a Lacus magazine a couple years ago, and I read them really closely. I think it was like late 50s.
Did you find that?
I think I mentioned that to you.
I tried to find that magazine. Mm-hmm. They did a big
thing
on it.
There was a photograph of all these guys taking their guide's licenses in Anchorage.
Oh, yeah. That's
and they're all in this room sitting around these tables. And I'm almost positive I can see my dad bent over a table because it was like the only time they were going to take that license for that year.
Oh, wow.
And that was about the time that he did it. And I'm almost positive he's in that picture.
I
got to get one to Tilly so she can look at it closer.
Yeah.
Okay. Alaska Magazine, and I've tried to come up with a copy, did a big expose on him and the bears of Prince William Sound. Mm-hmm. And it was a really good one. And haven't been able to get a hold of it.
In 1978, they did what they called deregulation and allowed pretty much all guides in the state of Alaska to guide in all areas of the state as long as you qualified. Prior to that, it was a much more like a limited entry system in which you were certified for certain areas like 13B or 14A. Dad did a lot of stuff out on the coastal area, out by St. Elias, in the Prince William Sound, Hinchinbrook Island, out even towards Kodiak. And at a time, he had the second largest area for bear hunting of any of the guides in the state of Alaska. But it's simply because he had produced that many bears.
Well,
he had produced like 26 bears in 4 years or something.
Yeah, yeah, and age caught up with him. I mean, that's a young man's
absolutely
game.
Yeah. Well, would you guys eat bear?
No.
No.
Unless I was starving.
I'll eat everything else. I mean, almost everything. Problem with bear is they eat salmon, okay? And that's the problem.
So shortly after moving there, the quake hits. This is kind of moving
64.
Along into other big events in Valdez's history. 1964, the earth starts shaking.
We were there about 3 years. Yeah.
Tilly and Tim, you were both just having
actually,
moved
Tilly wasn't at home that day. She was at babysitting, weren't you, Till?
It was a Good Friday,
I
mean, she was in
home,
town, but she was at a different house.
I was at a different house. And, you know, you got to remember that town was actually commissioned as a town in 1902, although the town was busy by 89, actually. But they became incorporated at that time.
Yeah. Well, it was about population of about 700 or so.
I would say they talk about it being 1,000, but that was because it happened in the spring and they were getting ready to resurface the road, so there's a lot of construction people in town.
Okay.
And but yeah, we were about 700 at that time. And I don't know if anybody out there is that familiar with the big quake. But it had a 200-mile radius, and it shook for 5 minutes. And the only place there's been an earthquake any bigger, and nothing is that long. We had a full 5 minutes of quake. Was in Chile.
Yeah, the one in Chile.
Chile had one just a little bit more.
And that was actually only a few years before.
Yeah,
1960, I believe.
And actually, I think as the research that I've done is that the most important thing that came out of the earthquake, and you don't hear it very much. But it proved tectonic plates. It rose and it changed position.
Changed.
And at that point, it was still considered the dried apple theory for geology, that the planet was cooling and the quakes were caused by that. So it's one thing that's the most important thing, I think, from the earthquake that came out of it. Because the guy that came up was from Menlo Park. They had a lot of geology down there. And
exactly what happened?
Yeah.
And it was that day he was given a presentation to say,
guy,
I'm giving up on this theory.
The guy whose name's Benjamin, something like that, he had just presented a paper about plate tectonics. And he, after about 3 or 4 years of just being knocked to the ground, we had the earthquake. And it proved it. Mm-hmm. On the same, like 2 days before. He'd given up his theory.
All I know is it scared the heck out of me. And
this was a 9. Yeah. Tilly didn't mention it. Not only was it 5 minutes, but it was a 9 in the Richter scale.
Yeah, 9. Yeah. And
it was horrendous.
Yeah, it was horrendous. And, you know, I was just a little child, 8 years old, with my little brother who was 7. And Tilly was sort of our mother, sort of, and she wasn't home. And it was scary.
It was scary.
Things were falling down all around us.
Well, Michael was the one that got... Michael had been going to get groceries, and when he came home... And I know that this is true, because I wasn't there, but all the kids that were with him had mentioned it over the years, but we were with Michael that day. Well, there was a huge crack that opened up in front of our house, and it never did close completely, but he was standing on it, and Steve Harrison, he had his groceries.
Well, I would say he was...
He didn't want to lose his groceries.
He was, what was the term? Straddled.
Straddling a crack.
Very good.
And it was opening up.
Oh,
it
wow.
Was, yeah, this was a horrendous thing. I thought that the house was blowing up when we heard it for the first time.
You were about, a block away? Another house?
Yeah, a block away.
Were you were watching some kids or something?
Well, messing around.
Yeah. Oh.
Anything else.
And so besides just the shaking, a tidal wave occurred in Valdez.
Well, the tidal
tsunami.
Was not a tsunami.
A tsunami, I'm sorry.
And it's actually, it's not really even a tsunami. It's a siege. That's a harbor wave.
Okay.
I mean,
technically speaking.
Yeah, but it
killed a bunch of people.
Well, the problem was is the Valdez was put down in a bad place. It was at it was only depositions from the glacier. And it was, we've been losing parts of the harbor every year. It's just out on big mud flats.
Yeah.
So when it went down, it wasn't very quickly after it started that we lost the whole harbor. It just started to sink. And that's when the China went up in the air and it managed to actually get going again.
Mm-hmm.
But what
killed,
happened that
what,
day...
31 people? 32? Something like that?
29. I think,
29.
That, included, I think that included Chiniga.
And there was one complete family that was wiped out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, not mother, but the father and three kids.
No, there was the Stewarts.
Oh, the Stewarts.
The Stewarts. They were the only reason I knew is that because one of them was in my class at school. They were all. It was commonplace in those days for... It was a social event.
Well, the big
when
ship,
the ship
when the China came in, that was when the fruit came in, if you bought a car or a fridge. So it's a big deal when the cleaner came in. Yeah. So the kids are all down there, and the chef was giving the kids stuff.
Yeah, throwing oranges at them and candy and stuff.
It was kind of like a holiday.
I think, if you look at it, it was commonplace in those days in all of Alaska, except maybe Anchorage or Juneau, where people, that was a big event. The ship only arrived every couple of weeks or maybe once a month or something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And that's a story that's too long, really, for this conversation here. But the amazing part is that we didn't lose more people.
Mm.
We weren't in school. The school didn't didn't do well. And so there was a lot of things that were good about that Good
Having
Friday.
Having a Good Friday.
So, yeah. Because we were all out of school.
Mm-hmm.
So Good Friday.
Our dad actually was on the dock.
Actually, no, Dad was not. I don't mean
that.
He was in the fire
He was
department.
On the dock earlier in the day, I think.
But he was in the fire department, and he watched it all from there.
Oh, wow.
So he saw everything from the second floor of the fire department.
Okay.
So he has the word.
He had a good view of it.
And we lost the boat
then. And then what was his role after? So the quake caused a lot of fire?
What it was is you had to, the fire was from the... They had a
diesel storage tank.
Diesel tank.
They're still on the beach.
Yeah, it's still there today.
Pieces of them, but we were like they caught on fire because one of them was not put together right, and it really opened up big. So when the fire started, it covered the whole. It looked like it was on the whole harbor. We all were told to get out of town, so we all did, and everybody formed a big, huge line at 6 Mile, which was the first time you actually get away from the ocean far enough where we were safe. We didn't know. Everybody kept thinking there was going to be a big tsunami coming in, but it never did. It was just a large wave. I think it was just high tide.
Okay. I as a little kid, since my sister wasn't home, and my stepmother, they just sort of shoved us into whatever vehicle stopped in front of our house, which was sort of a direct connect to the highway. So.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the back of this pickup truck with my brother and another guy.
And me.
And I was watching water roll up the road. It was knee high.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that probably leaves my memory more is that later on in the day, they took us up to this hill called 6 Mile Hill because they were concerned, like Tilly mentioned. But I got stuck in a car because I was going to freeze to death in the back of a truck.
We were all together in the back of that car.
You were in that car too?
Yes. I remember.
No, because I was with Raymond. Okay. Well, regardless, one of the ladies in the car... had just lost her fiancé on the dock.
Dad had to tell her
And
that.
She's sitting there crying for hours. And it was very depressing.
It was very difficult.
It was
very difficult. Away.
Yeah.
There was, when I remember that, I just remember the taillights going for about 2 miles. There were just taillights for all our cars.
Trying to get
and,
out of town.
Yeah, and the bridge had only a little place you could get over it. It was, for us kids, it was scary. And we hadn't seen Dad at all. And he's the one that broke the news to... Terry Brown, that she'd lost. That's Zook. His name
Zook,
was Zook.
Right. Zook, yeah. But the whole situation was like out of a
movie,
science fiction novel or something. I mean, it was like, whoa, because nobody was
prepared
to slide.
I saw the wave. We were outside. And at first they were saying it was 50 feet. It was about 30 feet.
30
but you had to put your head back. It just came right straight up because it was land sloughing.
Okay. Now, just to wrap up this section, after the earthquake, Valdez was moved, correct? Because it was in an unstable area.
Everybody left. Actually, you had to have a permit to stay. And Dad and a lot of the men stayed because you couldn't believe what it looked like down there because there was just brush and trees and stacked up like 6 feet high.
So are you talking about moving the town or staying in the old town?
The community had to be moved. Right. Valdez had to be moved to another location.
Because they wouldn't let us stay there anymore.
Okay.
There's still people out there.
But the ground was unstable, basically, in the old Valdez.
Well, it was sitting on...
The reason the earthquake damage was so bad was because of that reason.
Mm-hmm. Which is mud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just silt and stuff.
So now where Valdez is located, it's on?
It's actually on very good ground. We have bedrock at about 100 feet, and anywhere from 60 to 100 feet. And so it was a good place to grow, to be, because it'll withstand a lot. And there's a huge rock face that goes past the town, so it's very safe.
Won't happen again. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back. We are talking here to Tim, Tilly, and Eric here on the Alaska Identity Project. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a few minutes after this song. Thank you. This is Adrienne Lopez, and welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. We've been talking tonight with a historic Valdez family, Tilly Wonder, Tim Lopez, and Eric Lopez, who have been in the state for the last 50 years and telling their oral histories. We were first talking about the earthquake and some of the history of that there in Valdez. And now in the second part, we're going to get into some other very historic milestones or events that happened in Valdez, which as we kind of move along this timeline, Tim, we'd like to get into the decade of the 70s, because we were talking about the earthquake in 64. Then what really changes Valdez is oil, right? The discovery of oil.
Well, it changes Alaska.
The state of Alaska, right. And you were just old enough to get a job and actually help build the pipeline. Can you tell me why you decided to get involved in this?
Since we're talking about my dad and my older brother, actually my dad got involved with the Teamsters Union in the late 60s. Or he might have been involved even before that, but as far as my contact was when the pipe was shipped to Valdez, 1969. Tilly was living in Hawaii at the time. Michael was just getting out of high school, and he was involved with the transport of the pipe and storage of the pipe in Valdez.
And the coating.
And the coating. And there was a big gap. It was a 69 to 74 gap as the politics of various people got worked out. So that was a bit of a letdown, you know, economically, because people got all fired up about the pipeline when, and in fact, it didn't start for almost 5 years later.
Well, okay. Part of that was good, too, because they there was more rules put in about how to keep the land safe, and that was early on. That's really what happened.
Well, and ANSCA, of course, was the biggest issue that was resolved in that prime period. And, you know, the Alaska Native Land Claim Act.
Settlement Act.
That was really the big issue there. But anyway, he was working there, and then Michael was involved with the Teamsters on his summer, when he came home for the summer breaks in college. And so it was just natural that, you know, we would go for a Teamster job. I mean, here we are, the biggest construction project in the country, just about being built in your hometown. And it was hard to pass up working.
Yeah. It was 10,000 people.
10,000 people came to Valdez.
Yeah.
So they just kind of put out the call for people to come from all over the United States.
No, not exactly.
No, because you had to be pretty good at what you did.
Okay.
To work on the pipeline.
You know,
different jobs.
Terminal was the largest single project of the pipeline.
The Okies from Oklahoma. The welders.
And it was a union project, and the oil companies were in a very hurry. And, you know, it was tremendously profitable. Tilly's husband, Charlie Wonder, he was employed as a bus driver. And basically everybody in the Lopez family had a job working the pipeline.
Anybody that wanted to work from Valdez.
You know, so.
And then you could make quite a bit of money, right? Even now, by now standards.
No, today's
standards.
By now standards, it doesn't seem like much. But it was a lot
in all
in those days.
But if you look at it,
$700 checks every couple of weeks. That was a lot of money.
But, you know, it wasn't bad. It was, like you said, it was
we had to wait. You could,
$1,975, you know. It wasn't 2000.
You worked 3 weeks and then you... and then you were forced to take a week.
No, it was 9 weeks
12
on.
12 hours a day.
9 weeks on.
Two shifts.
And anyway, I worked 7/12s for 3 years. Yeah. And I know Charlie worked nights. I worked days. Michael and those guys worked. It was a fantastic opportunity that anybody with the right mind wasn't going to pass up. It was a huge impact upon our community and people's way of life. But we were so poor before it started.
We were going down the tubes at that point. We had our population down to a small amount because we were the road to the interior as the truckers and everything. I mean, those stories are just way too long for this. But we had been a big shipping place, and then when the train came through and went to Seward, it took away a lot of our income. Yeah. So the pipeline was, if we hadn't had the pipeline, the town was really going fast.
Interesting part of this, as far as my dad was concerned, he decided to opt out of this particular game. Mid 74, he was on his way south. Eric was just a small child, and that was, I guess, was when they first came in contact with Game. Is that correct, Eric? With Game Creek?
They owned
that property.
They came in contact with Warren McDaniels and the group that was up there at Edgerton, and effectively got religion really felt that something terrible was going on with the world. The world had changed, and they were going to go into the wilderness and get away from it. And so Mom and Dad came down to Southeast the first time, found some land, and purchased it. Actually assisted in the purchasing of another piece of land that's over in Haines later on, as I remember this. And they purchased 60 acres of land on Chichikov Island outside of Hoonah. And that's where we ended up moving that next year. But we stayed in Haines for about 6 months before we came down. We were kind of in between there.
I got a little sidebar story that people in the area probably appreciate. In 1975, I took a break from working for a week and flew down here to see Dad. And I was told that you guys were living in Haines at the time, but his boat was here in Juneau. So he says, yeah, I'm out at Tea Harbor. Well, I hadn't been to Juneau before. You know, Tea Harbor sounds, Tea Harbor, there's no way to get to Tea Harbor in those days. It was like, I had to walk or something beyond Ock Bay or something. And I get out there, and it must have been blowing 50 miles an hour. And Lynn Canal was so rough, there was no way to get back to Haines. I mean, the boat literally, I think, sat at Tea Harbor for like a month before they could get that thing back.
Wow.
And I got there, and I go, Dad, the boat was cold and windy, and my little brother Tommy was on board. And I said, man, we got to get out of here. Let's go rent a room up at the hotel, you know. So we went back up there, and I talked him into going back to Haines. I said, let's just catch the next ferry up there and just leave the boat here, you know. So we did, and that was my experience. And I tell you, even the Columbia, which was brand new at the time.
The ferry.
Columbia. We were rocking and rolling going up Lynn Canal that day.
Canal.
This was like January.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I don't want to be around here.
So it's funny, growing up in Southeast, I grew up here in the wintertime. We would commercial fish out of Valdez for 4 months in the summer, salmon seiners. But I guess I grew up without the knowledge that every child in the United States didn't use a ferry to get from place to place. But when you need to go get groceries, you didn't get on a ferry. When you need to go to the dentist, you didn't get on a ferry. I mean, that was just the way things were. I mean, you got on the big blue boat and went to sleep for a while, and you were there.
I mean,
it was good.
Eric pretty much spent most of his life on the boat.
Yeah, one way or another, I was on the water, that's for sure.
Now, you guys kind of segued into Game Creek, but Game Creek was a community that was established here in the late 70s, right, Eric?
No. Game Creek was established in the mid 70s, and I would say that it was it's one of those stories much longer than this show has, but it was started by a bunch of people who really felt that they were affiliated with a national group of I'm going to call them separatists, that really felt that there was something wrong with the way that the nation and the world were going, and they wanted to separate themselves from what they saw as, if you will, the evils of the modern world and get back to a much simpler life where they could practice their religion in the manner that they wanted to.
So they came from other parts of the United States.
Like the pilgrims.
Absolutely. They came from Canton, Ohio. They came from South Carolina. They came from Ware, Massachusetts. Those were the larger ones, the larger groups that came through. So.
And why did they choose Game Creek or Hoonah area?
I think the main reason is because we had purchased a piece of land and there was a place for them to go. I mean,
it wasn't cheap.
I don't think anyone asked us to pick that spot. I think that was Mom and Dad picked that spot, and some of the preachers, what they called the elder ministry or father ministry, they came, walked through it, liked it, and said, do it. So we purchased it at that point.
So how many people were living in this community, kind of isolated from...
At different times there were different amounts of people, but as I remember, probably the largest amount of people that ever lived out there was between 130 and 150 people.
Okay.
Permanent residents. There was, at the height of it, there was a sawmill and a school and a lot of agriculture. There were a lot of fields and harvesting of vegetables, food. An attempt to be as self-sufficient as possible that way.
And were you as much? I mean, did you have to go to Hoonah for something?
You had to go to Hoonah for something. You know, there were some of the, obviously, you still have to pay money on taxes on your land, and you still have to pay for fuel to run a boat, and you still have to pay for nails to put the boards together, even if you harvest the trees off your own land. But for the most part, they worked very hard to be as self-sufficient as they possibly could. So.
Nice. And was it overall a positive experience for you? Are people still living out there?
There are people still living out there, and there are, I think, actually more people coming out there now. There are, I understood that a couple of the cabins are being rebuilt, and there's a couple of young families that are going out there. One I know that is related to some of the people that were out there that moved there maybe 25 years ago, and some that are new people. So, I don't know, maybe there'll be a renaissance in the place.
Well, what did the people in Hoonah think of you guys?
I think we had a great relationship with the people in Hoonah generally. You know, they, I remember when we lost three of our men in a skiff during a return from a logging campus, as I recall that that's what it was. I was very young when this happened. And in the weeks that followed that, a couple of the elders there in Hoonah actually gave us space on Graveyard Island, which is the traditional burial area that they've got, so that our men could be buried there. I mean, we had mm-hmm. a great relationship, and people that left Game Creek ended up in Hoonah and ended up in having jobs both in the local industry and in a local government as well, helping run the towns.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that those folks being buried in that was a you know shine of respect for the Hoonah people. I mean, the Hoonah people towards the natives, towards the
Game Creek people. As a child, that we dad was a very gregarious guy, and we talked to old Charlie Jack and Richard Bean and the Dibdalls, and I remember us having great relationships with them.
Yeah, I think so.
Having the Lindoff boys stop by the boat and have dinner with us whenever we mm-hmm. were in town. I mean, I didn't know of any real animosity that was there at all. I think it was a very positive relationship.
Mm-hmm. So. And now, were you the only family that was living there that would go back to Valdez every summer?
Well, we were the only one that would go back to Valdez, per se, because we were the only... And we would bring young men with us to work on the boats. Okay. But we were from Valdez. There were several other commercial fishing ventures that were there in Game Creek, and they bridged out all over Southeast Alaska in that case.
Okay. Well, that's how I got as harbor master. I got to know a lot of these young men that came, like Sean Carey and his brother Russell and those guys. They came up with the boat, and you know, we developed relationships over the year. They were great people, and I always enjoyed my parents coming back into the harbor after being gone all winter, and I think they enjoyed getting out of there, too. I mean, I think Eric, you know, it was just a positive relationship all the way around.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Eric, later on, the commercial fishing was part of the family always, right? And you were on a boat that sank, correct? You almost died.
We still blame him for that.
I know, it's a few years later. Yeah.
In 92, I was kind of stepping up to the role of running boats after having crewed on them from childhood on till the time I could actually perform as an adult on the boats. And I lost our 52-foot seiner in 92. Out off of Bly Island, outside of Valdez and the Valdez Arm, and was never determined exactly why the boat went down. It was in February. The water was very cold. And,
you fell in the water?
To bring Dad back
they were
into
lucky
this,
that day.
We probably would not have survived, but Dad made us take a little 14-foot aluminum skiff with us, and he said, in case you guys get in trouble, you need to go to the beach or something. And I'll be darned if we didn't, it probably didn't save our lives because the boat went down very quickly.
It went down quick.
We swam.
Well,
we
really didn't. Nobody in the family blamed Eric. Everybody was happy they got off safely. Boats can be bought. You can buy new boats anytime you want.
They thought maybe, they thought it probably was a bulkhead.
Yeah, I think it was a bulkhead.
And it went down in 200 foot of water?
Yeah.
It went down in 200 fathoms of water.
Sorry.
There was no way to actually go down and check the boat out. That was always a little
insurance
question that was there. So, but yeah, that's
the ironically, it wasn't that far from where the Exxon Valdez smacked.
They got lucky.
Smacked.
The boat went down fast.
You know.
Yeah, and that's a good segue because this is a huge event that happened in Valdez, and it's crazy that it also was on a Good Friday in 1989.
Right.
You have the biggest oil spill in U.S. history before the BP, obviously, on a Good Friday, 25 years after the biggest earthquake in U.S. history, and also on a Good Friday. So Valdez, I guess every 25 years on a Good Friday is not that good, right?
I don't know. Valdez just has a magnet for being in the news. I mean, you know, something happens on a regular basis.
Why is that? This little tiny town.
I don't know. I mean, you know, Valdez
stories everywhere.
Valdez had the first governor of the state.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Egan.
Was born and raised in Valdez.
There was all kinds of political people from there in those days. Mm-hmm. And then just a series of disasters.
Bob Reeves
came there first.
Who's that?
Reeves.
That's right. Bob Reeves
was
opened
there.
Up the
Spirit of Valdez. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Meals.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, we've had a lot of. Well, the town was one of the first towns. We were the first incorporated town of South Central Alaska.
South Central.
And we were a big city then.
Yeah.
The miners came through there.
It was a major. access for the miners. I mean, that's really what it was there for.
Well, that Valdez, I do some writing about all this stuff, and at one point they decided that the best way to make money in Valdez was to supply miners. I mean, seriously, they made all their money doing that because they all came in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and then they found, by the way, that all the gold and the silver, which they went over the mountain for, over the glacier for, wasn't there. There was flecks of gold in every stream, but nothing you could live on. And Valdez, in the end, had within the port of Valdez, we had that gold mine that went 100 feet down and 100 feet out onto the bay.
Chute Bay.
Underneath. And right before Cliff Mine.
Cliff Mines, that's right.
And across was actually the part way, of the people were, tried to reopen that at a time.
But across the way, though, above where the terminal is now, silver, copper.
Yeah,
all there, that
definitely.
Stuff. So,
definitely.
Really, in the end, all those guys that went over the mountain and went over the glacier ended up coming back.
Yeah.
And there wasn't as many lives lost as is purported in a lot of things. So they talk about it being, you know, death's door and all that. But really, we didn't lose that many people, considering
that time period.
It's interesting about the – Tilly's making reference to gold in the Valdez Bowl. When we were building the terminal, I was on a crew that – or a fueling crew that took care of these machines. And one of the machines was breaking up rock to put in foundations. It was solid rock there.
Yeah.
And it was very common to pick up a piece of rock and you could see a vein of gold through it.
Really?
But it was only about a millimeter thick.
Huh.
The rock would be just an inch thick and it would turn it over. It was not on the other side. And it was gold all over that mountain.
Wow.
But just in little, minor amounts.
Yeah. So not enough to
do anything with.
They had to be stamped. You know, we had two stamp mills and there was many stamp mills out on the port. The history of the gold rush is very interesting there, but it's not like it is in any other place in Alaska. It's really unique in the way it was formed.
So, getting back to
you better go back.
Back to the oil spill.
We're
on
the oil spill because we don't have too much time left.
Go for
and
it.
I know Tim and Eric, you both were very involved in many ways in the spill, and there's quite a few stories.
And
Tilly's children as well. There's quite a few stories that came out of that that people maybe just in the news didn't hear. You know, this did get all over the news in the United States and around the world.
Yeah.
And people, and you were port director, harbor master at the time.
I was harbor master at the time, yes.
You helped clean up the spill.
On
the boats. So I guess, Tim, just kind of give us a little bit of context.
One of my interesting stories is I was asked to help Exxon for the first 3 days of the oil spill to set up a vessel dispatch center. So I was there, you know, long hours for 3 days, and then I had to go back to my job. But during that time period, we were getting phone calls from people from all over the United States. I don't know how they even got the number, but they did. And people were actually asking me where I could send money to. They
really?
Did the otters on TV. And, it, you know, if I had been unscrupulous, I'd have just opened up a checking account. I would have every lady in the East Coast sending me checks.
For the otters.
Yeah, for the otters, of course. But
Well, the otters, actually, the otters probably should have never been put in a situation where they were cleaned and everything, because most of them all died. But they definitely were a reason for people to care.
Yeah.
There's nothing like an otter.
How could you not care? I had the unfortunate circumstances of having the otter pin right below my office at the harbor. They had an otter for the clean otters, so the ones they were trying to clean, which I guess was unsuccessful.
It was.
But they cried like a baby.
Oh.
And it was so distressing. I mean, I'd have to sit and listen to these things for hours, I was like encouraging them to get the heck out of the harbor. You know what I'm saying? Move them somewhere else.
Just a lot of stress.
It was sad.
A lot of birds, but you just can't pull an otter, which is a mammal, out of covered with oil and whatever.
Yeah.
So, but it did bring a lot of people's hearts.
Yeah.
How many otters were killed? You know.
How many died? You mean?
Yeah,
it is a different way.
They were killed by the oil.
But there was because I know Bob worked on that project, Several hundred. Several hundred would be the right ones.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't bring in several hundred to try to clean.
No.
But it was the first time they'd ever had anything like this happen. And it was heartbreaking for everybody.
It was.
And there's no way, as humans, it was a way to people being sympathetic to what was going on.
And, you know, the amount of money that was thrown around for that, what did they say, Eric, yesterday? $2 billion was spent in five months or something?
A little over $2
billion. So just give us some context here. You've got the oil spill, and Exxon has no way to clean up what's going on.
Yeah, I guess everybody should know the oil spill was actually 19 miles from Valdez, and they all went south from Valdez. It didn't affect Valdez per se.
It actually moved out. We were very lucky because we ended up with all the bucks and
a whole bunch of other communities weren't lucky at all.
Kodiak and stuff got hammered.
Well, we got big wins right as that happened.
In March, yeah.
Yeah, we get our big wins, and it really costs.
You know, it's sort of in a way, it parallels the mining in a way, because it was always that boom-bust thing. And the spill was the same way. Within 24 hours, we had people crawling out of the woodwork, living in snowbanks under blue tarps. I mean, it was just amazing.
So people came in from all over the United States with the cleanup.
All over the world, I think.
Men, women, you know, the whole thing. And the cleanup. It's important to know, though, that during that oil spill, that's when we learned about a lot of things, and a lot of things were wrong. Mm-hmm. But it became a...
The promised us they couldn't do. That's one of the biggest wrongs of all. Yeah. Oil companies said for years, oh, we'll be able to handle it. They couldn't.
Well, you know, there was another little piece of information. It was right then, within a few days of the oil spill, that they all got together and said, oh, that's a 200-year thing. We don't even have to worry about that. that's not an exaggeration, everybody.
Having a disaster like that.
When it happened, like everything else that happens to us, we all go back and go, basically, our jaws drop. We've just had a lot of that kind of history behind us.
So, Eric, you're part of the family started to work on cleaning up the oil spill, right? Your family was contracted. Boats were then taken out. And what did you do? What was your role?
You know, we towed skimming machines. They were called Marco Class 5 skimming machines that were, even in their time, fairly antiquated. In terms of the technology involved with them, no one had ever really used them to clean up oil. They just designed them to clean up oil and built them, and there really hadn't been an application to use them. And the type of thing that they were applied to anyway was more towards like the Gulf in Florida, say, than it would be to cold weather, Arctic conditions. Situations where you have incredibly bad weather when it's cold out, the equipment couldn't stand up to the strain that we put it through just being in the environment, let alone the immensity of this spill. It was no one had even comprehended having a spill in a fairly enclosed area, even a hundredth of this size. It had never really happened before, and suddenly they were seeing. You know, when we were out there skimming it, they were seeing, skimming is the term that we use to picking up oil. They were realizing that if we continued to skim at the level we were skimming, it would take another 1.8 million years to pick up all the oil. You're getting 138 gallons a day.
What did you spend, about 6 weeks without coming in, Eric, or something on that week, summer?
On the first one, yeah. I spent about 6 weeks out, and then we went out for another 4 weeks, and then I went back commercial fishing after that. But yeah, it was solid turnaround. It was solid turnaround work in an attempt to get the stuff cleaned up. And one of the problems, this is a digression, I suppose, but one of the problems that happened with the Prince William Sound oil spill is that Prince William Sound is unique in the entire world in terms of the way that the geology of the sound is. There's more shoreline inside of an 80-mile by 89-mile cube of sound or square of sound than there is in the entire rest of Alaska. There are thousands of miles of shoreline, and a majority of that got some amount of pollution on it. At the point that people started realizing just the immensity of the pollution, they realized that there just wasn't any way that we could do it. So we were scrambling out there.
Well, it was a ground where everybody was learning new things.
Yeah,
so they
it
had
was.
No clue. And the boats that they were supposed to have in the water were actually sitting up shore. Covered with snow when this happened. Those were the boats that were supposed to take care of this.
To be there.
But the dispersant problems, it just was a big petri dish.
Yeah, it was like a comedy of errors. And, you know, as Harbor Master, the next 3 or 4 months after that was just complete chaos. And it was dumping thousands of people on you and hundreds of boats. But it was fun. I mean, in a sense, for me, it was fun.
How did you coordinate that? Was it just making up?
Well, you know, the processes were in place. I mean, we weren't the oil companies. We had figured out how to deal with it. It's expanded upon that.
Well, Exxon threw a lot of money at that.
Footprint. And, of course, Exxon was paying all the bills, which, of course, that was their responsibility. So any extra costs we had to incur, we would just pass it on to them, which was, I think, fair. But it was, in a way, it was exciting, and in a way, it was tragic, and you know, you can never say you missed. I'm not sorry I was involved with it, because it, you know, how can you not? I mean, Eric, you must feel the same way.
It was great. Absolutely. I mean, it
you know, was, I wouldn't have passed it up for nothing.
Matter of fact, I ended up teaching oil spill response to the University of Alaska because of the experience I had there, and then what those led to on other oil spills that I went to, because I had that experience.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it actually shaped my life for a period of time in terms of what I even did as a career.
Yeah, and of course, it led to your. I guess indirectly led to your job with the university now, in a sense.
Well, to some degree, yes.
Yeah,
it did.
Yeah.
Now, did people take advantage of the spill? Were there people out there stealing? I know that there were some stories that came up at one point about...
There wasn't much to steal.
I mean, I think there was probably always a little tiny bit of that goes on in any kind of major thing like this, because, mm-hmm. you know, the first month or so, the bookkeeping was pretty poor, but they straightened it all out as they went. But
it was
some interesting people, too.
You'd have to been there to see the...
Yeah, it was just chaos. It was like a war to me.
It's a little town, you know.
So population went from about 4,000 to how many?
Well, they had 10,000 across the bay. Okay. You know all those buildings they had?
Mm-hmm. But, you know,
the work camp that they had over there was full. Yeah. The Valdez, one thing, for anyone that's listening that wouldn't realize is that Valdez gets its worst snows in the spring. This happened right after the worst snows that we get. And things weren't on the beach, like sitting up on the beach where you could pull them off of there. Things were on the beach with 12 feet of snow on top of them. Mm-hmm. People didn't even know where the stuff was.
Yeah.
And so they just... That was part of the logistics nightmare that we were dealing with, is people knew that they had some equipment somewhere, but they were dug around for days to find some of this stuff just to know where it was and get it out there. Yeah. It was crazy.
It was crazy, too, because one incident, I walked through one of the hotels, was Westmark at the time, and I just was in a hurry to go somewhere, and I went by a room, and there was all these science-type guys all huddled in this room looking at the chart, and I realized they didn't really know where Bligh Reef was.
Really?
So I went in there and I said, here's where the tanker actually sitting, you know, and they were like, oh, thanks a lot, man. You know, because they had just come into town. I bet everybody packed their bag and left home in 24 hours type of thing, you know, so they had, get to Valdez, and the media was going crazy. I mean, everybody that stood still could get an interview. I was taking interviews in the middle of the night from East Coast companies and stuff. You know,
there's one point. I had the privilege when I was... On a boat called the Taku, running with that, to work with a group of gentlemen from Scotland, from the Shetland Islands. A company's called MPC. And they were like the only qualified people in the world to run oil skimming equipment, because they're the only people that had ever done it. And there's a place called Slough and Vaux where there was a really bad oil spill about 10 years before the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And ironically, it's within about 0.9 degrees latitude of Valdez.
Really?
And there's a Dr. John Winter does a presentation called Parallels at 60 North. But these gentlemen were the only people that had ever experienced cold weather oil spill response. And so I was fortunate enough to work with these guys early on. And they were hardworking guys, man. They would jump in and get oil head to toe, and a lot of other people were like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, man. These guys were in there.
What were they doing specifically?
They were running and repair. They would actually repair the skimmers that they were working on, rather than just dumping them off and going, oh, it doesn't work now. They would actually get in there and fix belts and out drives and all kinds of stuff.
Were these guys contractors?
Yeah, MPC was the name of the company.
And Taco was, for the listening audience, was another family boat that Eric ran. So we had a number of boats that were employed on the spill.
It's important, though, to remember that in the end, the good things that came out of the oil spill were the laws that made sure that they had boats that were ready and bringing in the fishermen. The fishermen went out and did a big amount of the work, just took off because there was nobody else to do that. Mm-hmm. So now the rules and regulations are at least more helpful, so mm-hmm. that we've had small spills.
Yeah.
But that they're... It's Eric. A different world, and Eric. It's a little safer.
I'm sorry, Eric, what was the name of the oil spill 90? What was that called?
Yeah.
Eastern Line.
No. The Act.
The Oil Pollution Act of 1990.
Yeah, that was probably one of the biggest.
Yeah, I mean, it established, that was cool because it established tanker speeds inside and outside of the Sound and Valdez Arm. It established the closure distance for tugs and escort vessels. Based on weather.
I think they changed the pilot station also. I think the drop-off of the pilot was extended.
Oh, absolutely. That whole the whole issue with the pilots was there, and also there were parameters created by weather. One of the things we actually did, I was involved with a group that was a watchdog, the RCAC, for a period of time when I was doing oil spill training. We actually raised the speed of tankers going through the narrows into Valdez and out of Valdez because you can steer a tanker better when it's going faster.
Right.
At a certain point, if you slow it down enough, if it loses speed in a short area, you can't steer it at all.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting thing that a lot of the stuff came out of it that actually made the place a lot safer that way.
I think so, for sure.
The other things that I'm not more of a Eric and Tilly like to deal with the detail. That was like one little thing that came up I thought was funny was within about 2-3 days, well, maybe a week, we had tons of people in Valdez. And, of course, they let a congregate around the harbor, so I had to deal with them a lot. And they started doing interviews on TV and stuff. And about, I don't know, half a dozen of them ended up getting arrested because they were wanted for warrants in other parts of the country.
No way.
And in the state. I'm serious.
people they were interviewing?
Troopers were arriving to arrest these guys because, oh, that's where you're at. These guys weren't geniuses by any stretch, you know, getting on TV because they thought it was cool. You know?
And they ended up arresting them.
Yeah.
And it's funny because my connection to the spill, you know, I was very young growing up in Valdez, 1989, obviously. I won't say how old I was, but I was young. And years later, I started working in a field, corporate social responsibility, and you see the origins of the movement all came out of the Exxon Valdez, because after Exxon Valdez, they created these principles called the Valdez Principles, which then created an organization called Ceres, and that organization then went on to be a worldwide leader in what they call reporting, corporate social responsibility reporting, and all of that really was a reaction after the Valdez oil spill.
Well, the men that we have in town now go all over the world when they have oil spills.
Mm-hmm.
Several of them. Mm-hmm. Serves was put in at that time, which I
can't
remember.
Ship escort response vessel system.
And that was part of the 90. Mm-hmm. And they go all over the world when there's oil spills now because they're the best.
Yeah, Valdez has a number of milestones that they can look back on.
Yeah,
some of them good and some of them not so good. You know?
You guys are a part of that.
Well, they'll always be debated whether what they were doing was right or wrong, because in the end, probably the oil would have dissipated a lot, but it's still there under the rocks. Never believe it's not there.
Still there. Go out and find it. We've got to wrap up this hour. I really appreciate the three of you coming on. Tilly Wonder, Eric Lopez, Tim Lopez, for sharing your stories, your history here in Alaska, and I wish you the best of luck. And
we could actually do a couple more hours, probably, but we can't. So.
That's good, because we could carry on, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
Shaping our state. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Adrian.